This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, a look at the Wild West of writing. A local author talks about the challenges and benefits of self-publishing. Plus, we'll get a sneak preview of his series debut, Cooper's Moon. But first, we're going to get a history lesson on the Gulf of Mexico, a deep history lesson. While they might splash in its waters while at the beach or spend time out in a boat or enjoy its fruits in the form of fresh local seafood, most people probably don't give the Gulf of Mexico all that much thought, except maybe during hurricane season when its waters can turn threatening. My guest today recently won the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for History for his 2016 book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. This epic nonfiction book takes readers on a ride from deep history through modern times, exploring the countless ways that the Gulf's waters have been both honored and exploited. It recently came out in paperback. Dr. Jack E. Davis is an author and professor of environmental history at the University of Florida. He's also author of An Everglades Providence, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas and the American Environmental Century, among other titles. He joins us from Gainesville. Jack, thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome, Julie.
And as always, we'd love to hear from you. What are your Gulf of Mexico stories? Or maybe you've read Mr. Davis's book and you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment. To join our conversation today, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So let's start with your motivation for writing this book. I want to know what made you decide to choose the Gulf as a topic for such an in-depth exploration.
Well, even though I live landlocked in Gainesville, Florida now, I grew up on the Gulf of Mexico, and so I have this lifelong intimate relationship with that wonderful sea. And nobody had written a history of the Gulf of Mexico when I was looking around for a new book to write after completing the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas biography, so it seemed like a right fit for me. But the other reason is I conceived the idea of the book before the 2010 BP oil spill. And that oil spill, you know, dominated news headlines for 87 days in the summer of 2010. And unfortunately, I believe that it robbed the Gulf of its true identity. People, when they think of the Gulf of Mexico today, or even if you Google it, you'll come up with an oil spill. And you mentioned hurricane. People also think of associate the Gulf of Mexico with as a hurricane alley or a vacation place. But I knew that the history, or I had an idea, that the history was much richer than that and much more expansive. And so I wanted my readers, who were not academics, I didn't write this book for academics, I wrote it for an intellectually curious audience. I wanted my readers, and for Americans, not just Gulf writers, too. So I wanted them to know that the Gulf has this rich and wonderful history that's a part of the larger American historical narrative.
It's true. It kind of did get known for its destructive headlines and, well, destruction that was done to it with that oil spill. But you're saying that there's a lot more to it than that. What is something that you think people may not really get? Maybe they need to look below the surface.
Well, first of all, what I maintain in the book is that Americans, all Americans, not just Gulfsiders, have both historical and ecological connections to the Gulf of Mexico. And you know, we've all heard of the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, and we think of that. When we think of the Louisiana Purchase, we think of the Great West and Thomas Jefferson was president at the time, doubling the size of the United States. But his principal motivation behind the Louisiana Purchase was to gain control of the Mississippi River. He paid double for New Orleans, one of the busiest seaports in North America. Then he paid double for that than what he paid for the rest of the Western Territory. And because whoever controlled the Mississippi, whoever, meaning country, France, Spain, or the United States, whoever controlled the Mississippi, controlled trade on the North American continent. And you needed, and of course the Mississippi runs to the Gulf of Mexico. And so that brought us our first Gulffront property. And Jefferson wanted Cuba, too. He encouraged subsequent presidents to go after Cuba because it sits right at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. It's a gateway between the Gulf and the Atlantic and the Caribbean. And so his belief, and others in Washington, was that whoever controlled Cuba controlled the Gulf of Mexico and consequently trade, but also American security.
So let's go even further back. You know, I always had heard that the Gulf of Mexico was formed by a meteor strike, but apparently that's not correct.
That's not correct. There was a meteor strike, but the Gulf of Mexico was formed with the breakup of the supercontinent Pangaea. And even though geographers, I love this, or I don't love it, I suppose, geographers regard the Gulf of Mexico as part of the Atlantic Ocean, which I think is a bit of a ripoff because the Gulf of Mexico is older than the Atlantic Ocean.
So if you were to have no water in it, would it look like a giant cereal bowl, or is it flat?
I think that's a pretty good description, a giant cereal bowl that has somewhat of a flat bottom. The average depth of the Gulf of Mexico is only 1 mile, and its steepest point, the 60 deep, is approximately a little over 2 miles. So it's a shallow body of water, but it's the 10th largest saltwater body of water on the planet.
Had you always known about the formation of the Gulf, or did you kind of discover this as you wrote the book?
No, I discovered when I wrote the book. There were so many wonderful surprises. Check the index of virtually any history textbook, U.S. history textbook assigned in high school or college, and you won't find the Gulf of Mexico in the index. And if you do, it's only mentioned in passing. So there was much about the Gulf of Mexico history that I didn't know until I began researching and writing this book. And as I said, just some wonderful surprises, and it turned out to be just this really fascinating history.
Well, I mean, not only the Gulf, it seems like there's a little bit in there about the indigenous people who surrounded the Gulf, mainly the indigenous people who were first to arrive in what we now call Florida. Can you tell me a little bit about these people?
Yeah, I write quite a bit about the Clutha that many of your listeners are familiar with. And what's interesting about the Clutha and their ancestors is people generally lived around the Gulf of Mexico from 8,000 to 10,000 years, and, you know, from Mexico all the way around to Florida. And the Clutha, what I find most fascinating about them is that they were a sedentary people, meaning they were not nomadic, but they were hunter-gatherers. And that's highly unusual among hunter-gatherers. They tend to be nomadic. They follow their food. They follow their game. But the Clutha didn't have to go anywhere because it all came to them right there in those the wonderful estuarine environments around Fort Myers area and Pine Island Sound and Tarpon Bay and of course, Caloosahatchee River. And so they took anywhere from 90 to 95% of their protein from the estuarine environment. They didn't even have to hunt land animals if they didn't want to, and they did not grow crops.
Yeah, it was interesting also the formation of some of the mounds from the shells that they would discard. We hear a lot about that down in this area.
That's right. Some of the mounds were so-called kitchen middens, or they were refuse mounds. Some of them were, ceremonial mounds, and some of them were or burial mounds. Excuse me. And this is true all the way around the Gulf. The shell mounds around the Gulf were practically, as I write in the book, shoulder to shoulder. There were so many, and they really stood out. The Spanish, when they first arrived in the 16th century, were quite impressed by all these shells. But they were also impressed by the size and the general physical health of the native peoples around the Gulf of Mexico. They tended to be inches taller than the Spanish, who, of course, came from an agrarian society. The Spanish just admired the Gulf native peoples physically.
It's kind of interesting, though. You're talking about a large body of water, but the things that people who lived around it, what they would consume, leading to a different stature and height and health. It's so interesting how these things, environmental like this, can have such an impact on the people that live around them. So were the first people that got here after the Native Americans, were they Europeans, were they Spanish? Those were the first?
On record, as far as I know, the Spanish were the first to arrive. And probably the first or at least again on record, to enter the Gulf of Mexico was Ponce de Leon in 1513 when he came, landed probably at Port Charlotte, and he encountered the Calusa, who chased him off. But the Calusa knew about the Spanish before the Spanish knew about Florida or even the people of, you know, the indigenous people of Florida, because these were seafaring people. They went all over the place. They went down to Cuba. They paddled the boats to or sailed to the Bahamas. And so by word of mouth, they were aware of the Spanish in the Caribbean. But, you know, they also found strange objects and bearded men who had washed up on shore after storms. And when Ponce landed in the Port Charlotte area, he encountered an indigenous person who spoke some Spanish words, which, you know, must have shocked the heck out of him.
Yeah. That would be a shocker. Hey, I've done stories on this show before about mapping Florida. Was it difficult to get the Gulf of Mexico mapped because of the shifting tides in southern Florida at all?
Oh, yeah. It's, the other thing that Thomas Jefferson did was he signed the legislation that created the U.S. Coast Survey, which was responsible for mapping the wet edges of America. And the Gulf was just a frustrating place for them because, like any map maker, that you want to find this clear divide between land and water. And that was really difficult in, around the Gulf of Mexico and because of the mangrove shoreline, and but also because of the coastal marshes. And so there was no clear line, and
they're more fluid. No pun intended.
Yes, no. That's you're absolutely right, and it's a good pun. It was very much a fluid line, and so that was frustrating. And you know, in storms, they were frustrated by storms. They were frustrated by the mosquitoes, and probably most of all, the no-see-ums just drove them the Coast Survey crews crazy. I probably drove a few of them mad.
Yeah, that is kind of a timeless, maddening situation, too, because they're starting up again already this season. I'm joined during this part of today's show by Dr. Jack E. Davis. He's the author of the 2018 Pulitzer Prize-winning history book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. It's a sweeping nonfiction epic that tells the story of the Gulf of Mexico from deep history through today. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Now, Dr. Davis, people have fished Gulf waters from prehistoric times until today, but when did what you might consider commercial fishing get started in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, so the Spanish occupied pretty much controlled the Gulf of Mexico for 300 some odd years. The British were on the Gulf for a short period, and the French for a good time as well. And neither the Spanish, neither the French launched into commercial fishing. The British tried, but they were only in the Gulf for about 20 years. And so outside of some Cuban fishermen who came up to fish around in your part of the state mainly for mullet, it was really the Americans in the early 19th century who started the commercial fishing industry in the Gulf of Mexico, and that was by New Englanders. And this is another surprise that I really loved. New Englanders started coming down, but they were already in the early 19th century fishing out some of their grounds in the Northeast, and so they would come down in the wintertime, our original snowbirds, if you will, and they'd fish for the season, and then some of them stayed behind. And by the late 19th century, you could go to virtually any commercial fishing port on the Gulf of Mexico, and you would hear a New England accent as readily as any other accent on the Gulf of Mexico.
You know, I'm going to throw to a quick break real quick. I'm kind of having a difficult time understanding you because of the connection on our phone line. So I'm going to go to a quick break, Dr. Davis, and we'll call back and see if we can get a better, more clear connection, because I'm really interested in understanding pretty much every word that you have to say about this. It's a really intriguing subject. So let's go to a break, and we'll be right back.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. A Canadian company that sells marijuana around the world just went public on the New York Stock Exchange, something U.S. cannabis companies aren't allowed to do.
We are literally giving the next multi-billion dollar industry, you know, the next internet boom to the Canadians.
Canada's upper hand in the global pot boom. Next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.
You're listening to Gulf Coast Live, and I'm Julie Glenn. We're talking in this part of the show with Dr. Jack E. Davis. He's an author of the 2018 Pulitzer Prize-winning history book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. It's a sweeping nonfiction epic that tells the story of the Gulf of Mexico from deep history through today. We have a better phone line, I think, right now. Can you hear me, Dr. Davis?
Oh, yes, I can hear you just fine.
Oh, this is much more clear. So we were talking about fishing, but I wanted to go into how the ways that humans have kind of exploited some of the natural resources in and around the Gulf and how that has impacted birds. You wrote a little bit about that, too.
Right. I organized the chapters in the book around natural characteristics of the Gulf of Mexico, birds, fish, beaches, rivers, weather, of course, oil. But also estuaries. And the Gulf of Mexico is one of the richest estuarine environments in the world. And of course, our very robust commercial fishery is born from those estuaries. So $1 billion sport fishing industry is born from it as well. And our greatest impact on the Gulf really has been on those estuaries, diminishing them through various ways. Pollution, of course, both agricultural runoff and industrial discharge, and wastewater treatment or poorly treated wastewater in engineering projects. And so in the 1970s, by the 1970s, we had devastated bays and bayous all around the Gulf of Mexico. The seagrass beds in those bodies of water had shrunken 60, 70, 80%, 95% in the case of Escambia Bay because of raw sewage and industrial runoff.
So when did people start thinking about, hey, maybe we need to take better care of things?
Well, I think there were people fairly early on who were arguing that going as far as the sport fishing, it's really tarpon fishing in Fort Myers that launched the tourist industry on the Gulf of Mexico, not beaches. And this was in the late 19th century. And you could catch a couple dozen tarpon in a week or two in the Fort Myers area. And I'm talking fish that were between 100 and 200 pounds. But by the turn of the century, by 1900, the sportsmen and women realized that there weren't as many tarpon, that there was an impact. So people started calling for catch and release as early as the early 20th century. Hmm. But the real push to restore the bays, restore the seagrass beds, came after World War II, but also stopping the dredge and fill projects and stop ripping up the mangroves, because mangroves are part of an estuarine environment, as are the coastal marshes. And one of the loudest voices early on opposing the destruction of mangroves and opposing dredge and fill projects was John D. MacDonald, the great fiction writer of the 20th century who lived in Sarasota.
So then we had the discovery of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. When did that happen?
Well, oil was discovered. Well, the Spanish actually came upon oil in the 16th century. They didn't really realize what they were looking at. They didn't realize they were looking at the future. We'll put it that way. But it was the early 20th century that companies were organized to begin drilling oil near the water and even a few feet out into the water. But the first out-of-sight-of-land offshore oil well was drilled in 1947 off the coast of Louisiana. Here's another surprise, Julie, is that I found a direct connection between that 1947 oil well, and the great actor Jimmy Stewart.
Really?
And I'm not going to tell you what that connection is. If you want to know, you got to read the book. I like teasing my audiences now and then.
Oh, well, that's real nice. Thanks. That is pretty interesting. But, I mean, you know, then fast forward, you got the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster. And I was here during that. And it's strange because you don't really hear, I mean, for people living right here on the Gulf, we don't hear much more about it. And it seemed like, while at the time it was very devastating, you don't hear much about after effects anymore. Are there still effects from that that have not been accounted for, or that are being accounted for, but we just don't hear about?
Yes. I mean, you can still, there are still beaches up in the northern Gulf and the western Gulf in which on stormy days they'll find tar balls washed on shore. And the jury's still out on the, you know, the continuing impact of the oil well. And scientists are studying that now. And but you know, as I write in the book, the BP oil spill is the worst oil spill in U.S. history. And as tragic as it was in terms of the cost of in human lives and of course the ecological cost, it's not the worst ecological disaster that the Gulf of Mexico has suffered. Every day is an ecological disaster that exceeds the BP oil spill 2010. When you consider what still comes down these rivers, the rivers that flow to the Gulf drain some 80% of the continental U.S. And so whatever somebody in Minnesota or Iowa puts down a stream or directly into the Mississippi River, for instance, ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. Some of that stuff is fine, some of it's not so fine, such as nutrient overload from agriculture in the Midwest. And but engineering projects, causeways and bridges, jetties, and of course channels and canals, all of those things have affected the estuarine environment, has affected the nearshore currents, which can have a negative impact on the estuarine environment. And as far as the oil industry, the real damage comes from the onshore infrastructure that supports the offshore facilities, pipelines. There are 10,000 miles of canals that the oil industry has cut through the Louisiana coastal marshes, a marsh area that's unequaled in the United States, but 10,000 miles of canals to run their pipes and run their boats, and which is devastating. It's leading to a tragic erosion of the Louisiana coast.
Well, it's interesting that you're talking about the man-made canals and these pipelines and things, but then when you just look at how the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the way that they have changed the way that the Mississippi River acts by putting up, you know, locks and dams and all of the berms along the sides to keep it from flooding and try to control it from flooding out and dumping out all of what is put into it and just channeling it right down into the Gulf. And we're seeing that down the Mississippi, and then also with the Lake Okeechobee releases going through, on the other side, St. Lucie, but then the Caloosahatchee River, basically just funneling all of that directly into the Gulf. I mean, how much of this, like what you're talking about, is a daily disaster has happened since the 1930s, 1940s, and when they started building all of these things?
Yeah, the real growth, you know, the major growth period comes after World War II, and everything that we had begun doing before World War II is accelerated and amplified. And, you know, our growth in Florida exploded after the 1950s, and it's the same for other parts of the Gulf as well. And even though there were oil refineries around Louisiana and Texas before World War II, it's really after the Second World War that those two coasts become dominated by the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, and then just thinking about all that runoff, when you talked about the Mississippi River, I've lived along the Mississippi River before, and it's really interesting how the landscape and the path of a river has been altered by human beings. And then, you know, the intensive agriculture along the the riverbed where it would normally, where it used to flood, it was very highly nutritious soil that is no longer getting flooded because now there are farms there. So it's really an interesting situation that we're dealing with. So as maybe a postscript, where do you think things are headed for the Gulf?
Well, you know, I like to emphasize that the book is not all doom and gloom, and I end on a hopeful note, end the book on a hopeful note, and because I am generally hopeful about the future of the Gulf of Mexico, and for a couple reasons. One, as I said, I grew up in the Gulf, and when I was a kid, you know, virtually, as I mentioned earlier, virtually every bay and bayou along the coast was a dead body of water. There wasn't much bird life around. I spent a lot of my childhood on the Tampa Bay area. But we've done a marvelous job, we meaning state, federal, and local agencies, many non-profit, private organizations that rely on poorly paid staff and hundreds, if not thousands, of volunteers. And they brought those bays and bayous and sounds back to life, just vibrant life. But the other thing that gives me hope is that those people are still working. You know, since this book came out, as I said earlier, my main objective was to restore the identity, the true identity of the Gulf, let my readers know that, and Americans know that the Gulf is more than just this oil supply, and it's more than just a vacation spot or Hurricane Alley. And the response has just been tremendous. The enthusiasm, you know, the book winning the Pulitzer Prize, to me, is as much about the Gulf of Mexico as it is about the work. And there's this wonderful enthusiasm around the country from coast to coast. People really do appreciate the Gulf as something other than an oil supplier. And so that's what gives me hope.
So I know that you're on the side of the road on your way to the Pulitzer Award ceremony. Did it surprise you that people had that kind of a reaction, that they love the Gulf as much as you did?
Well, you know, things seem to be building. The book garnered really nice reviews, and the major, national publications, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and others. And so that was obviously very pleasant. It wasn't anything I expected. Obviously, every writer hoped for reviews in those venues. And then it won the Kirkus Prize in the fall, and then it was the finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. But I figured that was it. My editor and I were both at the ceremony at the National Book Critics Circle Award in New York. We were both saying, well, we've had, and this was in February, as I recall, and we said, the book's had a nice run. And we both figured it was all over, and I was totally caught off guard by the Pulitzer Prize, which was announced on April 16th. I wasn't even following it.
Did they call, or did you just get an email, or how did that work?
Well, I'm in my office, of all things, on campus, in a meeting with a student talking about his floppy writing, and my cell phone's exploding, my office phone is ringing off the hook, and I'm trying to ignore it, and finally I just decide maybe I better see what's going on in case there's an emergency. And I looked at my text, and there was one from my editor saying that the book had won, and my response is not something I can repeat on public radio. It starts with holy, we'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And
you said
and
to your
then,
student, and, keep trying and
no,
maybe you.
I couldn't talk. I was speechless. I had to slide the phone across my desk so we could read the text. I really didn't know how to speak at that moment.
Wow. What did the student say? Well, can you repeat that?
His eyes bugged out, and he smiled. I think because I was reading the riot act, I think it was. He may even think, "Oh, good, I get out of this meeting."
That was very welcome news, also to that student.
But
sure.
I have to say, the response from the University of Florida community, students, staff, all the way up to President Fox, has just been wonderful. It's been, and around the state, it's also. I think I've given 9 talks. since the Pulitzer, and everybody's just in four states, not just Florida, and everybody's just so enthusiastic about this positive attention for the Gulf of Mexico for a change.
Yeah, I think, and I like that what you said is just is as much as about people's interest in the Gulf as it is the book itself. I think that was a very humble and nice thing to say. But I want to tell you, congratulations, a Pulitzer Prize. Way to go!
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Jack E. Davis. He's the author of The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea, which won the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for History. He's also a professor of environmental history at the University of Florida. Professor Davis, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, if you've ever thought you should write a book but don't have the first clue how to navigate the world of literary agents and publishing houses, maybe self-publishing is for you. We'll talk with a local author who took that route and learn about his new novel, Cooper's Moon. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.